Remaker's Mark, Episode 26, Modern Times. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are in Part 2 of Episode 26, where we are once again discussing modern times. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing tonight? And did cinema die with the onset of the talkie?
I'm great, thanks, and you bet it did.
I'm sorry, that was terrible. I'm sorry.
1920s yeah, Jimmy is back.
I'm good.
We're not going to let you do another take on that, so you're going to have to be okay with that.
I don't want to. I'm good, and I think that cinema was changed forever with the advent of the talkies. Mostly for good, but not all. Was that the answer to the question? I forgot what you
asked. That was perfect. That was absolutely perfect. I actually asked if you like ketchup or mustard on your hamburger, so that's weird, but
Worcester
whatever.
Sauce.
yes, Worcester. Jeremy Nilsson, how are you tonight? And did cinema die with the onset of the talkie?
I'm doing quite well also. And I believe cinema died with the onset of Technicolor.
Ooh, nice. Flipping it for real. Lee here in spirit, how are you doing tonight? And in your opinion, did cinema die with the onset of the talkie?
I'm doing all right, and still too early to tell.
Ooh, good answer. Nice. Oh, man, that's professionally handled. Nice work. Mark Josting, how are you? And in your opinion, what we talked about with the cinema and the dying and the talkie and whatnot?
I'm sorry, that was...
Was that a question?
You really phoned in that question.
Who? What? No, I asked how you were doing. That's a question.
No, the other one.
The question?
Cut.
Yes.
The babe?
The rhyme of the
pancakes.
I'm sorry. I've only asked the question three exact times so far. I thought, you know, I probably don't need to say it for a fourth time. But apparently I was wrong. Hey, Mark, how are you? Also, did cinema die with the onset of the talkie, in your humble opinion?
Hey, Gail. I'm fine, thanks.
Hey, cool. And
it did not die, but it lost some of its magic.
Indeed. All right, and to close us off here, my name is Kyle Delahunt. I will again be your host this fine, fine evening. And I'm going to abstain. I think it's too early to call, too. Lee, I think he nailed it with that one. So good work.
Thank you very much.
You are very welcome. So before we continue our discussion of modern times, we want to thank our friends at Modern Antics for their promotional consideration.
Modern Antics presents Goofta, a concert of novelty songs performed by Minnesota artists, November 8th at Amsterdam Bar and Hall. Your favorite local musicians perform covers of well-loved novelty songs, including Tom Lehrer, Monty Python, Weird Al, TV themes, and more. Interested in other Modern Antics events? Check them out at modernantics.com or on Facebook and Twitter at Modern Antics.
All right. Thanks again to Modern Antics for their promotional consideration. Again, before we want to jump into the second part of our discussion here, we want to talk a little bit about the recasting side of things. So as usual, we put a call out to Facebook and Twitter to see if people had casting suggestions for, in this case, the Charlie Chaplin role in the original. So we asked who could fill Charlie Chaplin's vaguely clown-sized shoes in a remake today. And friend Levi Weinhagen said, I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt could crush that role, or maybe Ty Burrell of Modern Family fame, both of which I think are really, really excellent picks. I would agree with both of those. And then Jeremy Dorsing said, besides Johnny Depp, ? So what was the role that you guys referenced Johnny Depp sort of channeling?
Benny and June. Benny and June. From, I believe, 1994, 93, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Gotcha. Cool. So yeah, those are good picks, and that was pretty much it. Nothing from Twitter. So we had quiet Twitter folks this time.
I blame us.
Yeah, that's our bad. That's yeah, okay. Yeah. We're busy and forgetful, so it happens. All right. So also, we want to talk about the casting picks that we made in part one. So who were the big winners there? So for the role of Neil Gaiman, originally played by Paulette Goddard, we went with Jer's choice of Lauren Cohen. So congratulations, Jer. That's a good pick.
Yay.
For a factory worker, originally played by Charlie Chaplin, we went with my pick of Martin Freeman. And for the minor characters, we chose Jer's choice of Richard Reilly?
Really?
Really? Really? For the role of the mechanic. So good pick, Jer. I like that. So Jer was the big winner, and he happens to be next alphabetically, so he is going to be picking the next movie. Jer, tell us what the next movie is that we are going to be discussing here on Remakers, Mark.
The comedy drama from the late 80s, Good Morning Vietnam, starring Robin Williams.
Nice. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. I'm excited.
As am I.
Yep. I don't think I've seen it since the first time I saw it. I'm really excited to revisit that.
It's a great one.
I just watched it within the last 2 months since Robin Williams' passing. That was the movie I chose to watch as sort of his honorarium. No, that's not nice. The right word.
Memoriam?
Memoriam. Honorarium is if I gave him money, I guess.
His arboretum?
I guess if you sort of paid money to watch it, it could be an honorarium.
Sure.
Maybe.
His hard to say. Burrito-arium. Okay.
There we go. I like it. So, yeah, that'll be fun. We're excited about that. That'll be a darn fine time. Okay, so now let's move on to our continued discussion of modern times. Man, I keep almost saying modern antics. Wouldn't be a bad thing, just wouldn't be accurate. Our continued discussion of modern times and the plot, tech, and filmmaking changes that we would make to the movie. So, first and foremost, the big question is, too silent or not too silent, or in the David Lynch style in which we followed that up, silencio o no silencio? Lee, can you say that for us? Oh, Lee.
That's classic, Lee.
It really is.
You sound so good.
So the big question here is, do we make our remake a silent movie or not? Now, each of those, whether silent or not silent, has their own sets of strengths. So if you make it a silent movie, it sort of upholds the spirit and style of the original. It could be really interesting and unique. You don't really see many silent movies nowadays, and you especially don't hear many silent movies.
Hey-o!
Eh? Eh?
I can't think of a single one I've heard.
Yeah, funny that. And I think there could be some really great opportunities for physical acting in a silent movie. And then on the non-silent side, obviously that's more in line with what today's filmgoers are used to and what they expect and what they, you know, maybe want. So, you know, you've got both strengths and weaknesses in each of those areas. So I'll put my hat in first in that I think we should make it a silent movie. I think it would be a really interesting opportunity. I don't think we have to necessarily remake it in a way that is exactly like the original. We're going to talk about some elements of the silent movie that we really liked. But I don't think we need to make it exactly in the style of the original, but I think making it a silent movie would be really, really interesting. So that's my stance on the matter. Jer, what is your stance on this?
My answer is I think that it should be a hybrid of both, and I think we'll probably touch on that in a little later segment of this conversation. But I think that I would love to see this in the spirit of a silent film and to get all of the wonderful and beautiful things that silent film did that we don't have anymore. I would want that. But on the opposite side of that coin, I don't think that you could market a silent film and have it be successful. So I think that there is a way to do both, and I believe I'll be talking about that a little bit later. But that's my answer is yes.
Okay. I like it.
I think it's more of a yes?
Yes, question mark, yes-ish. I'll take that. No, that's fair. Andy, to you, what is your stance on the matter?
I agree with Jer, actually. I think this would be fun to do as a hybrid of sorts, because really this movie is originally a hybrid of sorts, as we already touched upon in the first episode. There are spoken voices in this movie that we hear. There's only a few characters, I think, that we actually hear speak, but one of whom is actually the factory worker, Charlie Chaplin's character. Although he sings.
We hear him sing.
We hear him sing in gibberish, but still, we hear him.
Or is it French?
I believe it's gibberish.
They're the same.
Oh!
I'm sorry, French listeners, of which we have zero. I'm still
now
sorry.
Now we have zero.
Now we officially have zero, yeah.
I read somewhere, probably IMDb trivia, that when he was going to sing, he didn't want to ruin the mystique of the Little Tramp character by having him all of a sudden speak in a language with a voice, so to speak. And so he wanted it to be unintelligible.
Fair enough. All right.
I don't speak French, though, so I could be wrong.
Is that actually his voice?
I believe so. But again, I could be wrong. Okay. But I like the idea of making in the spirit of the original, a bit of a hybrid. And what I was thinking would be kind of interesting to have, you know, you have to have a soundtrack, but to have a lot of, have all of the ambient atmospheric noise, everything there except voices. So the only thing, pardon me, the only thing that would be silent in the film are the voices. I think that would be, would funnel the story and the talents in such a way as if the entire thing was a silent movie. I think it would just be interesting to hear things like doors opening, people walking, just, you know, all of the things that you'd hear, especially if you're in a factory setting, hearing everything that's going on around. And the only thing that you wouldn't hear again would be the voices. So that would be how I would like to play it.
So you want to cast a non-silent movie and then just have it entirely cast by mutes.
I believe that's a very offensive term. I believe they prefer to be called non-speakers.
Non-speakers.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Like you would actually have not Foley doing the sounds, but the actual sounds
of the movie. I think it'd be kind of fun to have. I mean, you probably have a little bit of Foley. I think every movie has a little bit of Foley to amplify sounds that you want amplified, but wouldn't be picked up in, you know, the recording of the movie. I think every film has that, and I wouldn't be opposed to that. I just think the only thing that would be fun to remove would be the actual voices.
And that just feels weird to me.
Well, if you think about the original movie...
I'm on board with it.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
The original movie, to a degree, does this. There's a lot of atmospheric sound. Granted, it's you know, done almost entirely probably as Foley, but... there's a lot of atmospheric sound that goes on to kind of, you know, represent what's happening in the environment. Crowd noises. I think there are sounds of cars, all these things. And of course, the soundtrack that's kind of constantly going in the background. But you rarely ever hear anyone speak. So I don't think it would really be that jarring if you heard and saw a finished product of that. I don't think you would see that and think, wow, it's weird they're not talking. I think you would see that as, oh, this is an interesting kind of a hybrid silent movie, which is exactly what I'm going for.
It's probably less jarring than I'm imagining in my head.
All I'm saying, Jer, is that my plan is flawless.
Okay. I believe you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that plan.
Thank you.
I dig it.
I have a slightly more flawless plan.
Ooh. Please share, Mark.
Yeah. And that's
flawless.
I'm going to take a couple of major cues from some recent works. Something that's incredibly recent. I just saw today. It was a short film from Rocket Jump, which is which is Freddie Wong's production company. And they're the geniuses behind, Video Game High School. Which everybody needs to see because it's fantastic. But anyway, like special effects wizards, just brilliant comedic film makers. There's one short film that I saw from them today that where it was not a silent film, but there was no dialogue, and all the main characters made sounds, but they're all like effort sounds or guttural noises. It's they make noises, but they don't ever speak.
So they're caveman?
No, it's just they don't speak. There's no dialogue, and that's it. So it's not silent, but there are no words, and I think it's used to brilliant effect in this film that I saw today. I think
was that film called The Quest for Fire?
No, and you're horribly off base here. But another example, which will probably resonate with you, Andy, is Mr. Bean.
That does resonate with me.
Yes, because there we have Rowan Atkinson's main character, you know, going through really most of his screen time in anything in which he's appeared, not speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally he does little noises like just like that.
Wasn't that the voice you used to describe one of the characters from Beowulf?
Yes, Grendel.
Grendel, that's it.
Yeah, totally.
Anyway,
that's a very good modern analog to what I think you and I are kind of describing, sort of together.
Yeah, and really, I think that you and Jared and I are all on the same page with a hybridized silent film, where, you know, even if it's not technically a silent film, and maybe some characters speak, maybe no characters speak, but they all they make noises. It still maintains that magical quality of the silent film,
mm-hmm.
where you're focusing on the physicality and the expressiveness and all the things that made 1920s comedies wonderful.
and you allow other elements to take the place of the vocals of the voice, things like the soundtrack, things like, I think the soundtrack is probably a good example just because you get these cues from the music that almost act as punchlines, you know, that serve as the audience's cue to, oh, that was a joke.
Ha 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 ha.
The original laugh track.
Mm-hmm. Ha, yeah. Ha, ha, yeah. Ha 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 ha
ha. With the onset of a lot of current video games, The Sims being probably the most prevalent because it's so hugely popular and has been for a decade. But there's more video games besides that one that want to accomplish a similar talking without actually saying anything. And so The Sims kind of brought it into the mainstream, and they even call it Simlish, the language, but it is just unintelligible garble. And I can kind of picture something like that. And I think that doing something like that in a movie would actually resonate with people who are used to seeing that in other mediums like video games and television shows.
Yeah. I think this has existed in shorts quite a lot, actually, like thinking of even a lot of like the Pixar and Disney and DreamWorks shorts that have occurred before those films, like Jerry's Game, the one that was before Wreck-It Ralph. Now I can't remember the name of it, but it's a man who's throwing paper airplanes and he meets somebody on the skyway.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, the subway.
Oh, yeah.
It's a brilliant
one. So, I mean, you know, a lot of that stuff where it's so much emotion is communicated with actions and facial expressions. So I think that's very, very tangible for a 12-minute, 10-minute, however-minute thing. But I think, you know, we would see if that could work for 80 minutes, 90 minutes, however long this ends up being. I think it can, but I think it would be a test of viewers in a way that I think from an artistic standpoint would be a really interesting risk, but I think one that would be worth taking, and I think would open up a lot of really interesting directorial options.
I think you bring up a point, though, Kyle, that in those short films that you're referencing, there's not dialogue, where in the silent films that I'm referencing, there actually is dialogue. You just don't hear it.
Right.
So I think there's a difference where I agree for a short piece, having those nonverbal conversations or stories make a lot more sense and are a lot easier to, they hold the audience's attention much more readily. But in a feature length film, I would definitely want there to be dialogue. You just wouldn't hear it. You'd see it on the screen. You'd see the little placard with whatever they said. But I like in this movie, in modern times, there's actually not much of that. There aren't very many, you know, the placards that say whatever it was said. There's a lot of implied conversation.
Yeah. There are maybe a handful of intertitles.
Yeah.
Yeah, there really isn't as many as I thought there would be.
I think Three Amigos honestly probably has more.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're probably right. Agreed. I think it would be really interesting to try to do. And again, I don't think this is the right choice, but it would be really interesting to try to do no dialogue, all expressions, you know, where it's maybe that won't work for 90 minutes, but, you know, basically as though like they can't speak, like they have a spell or something. And again, now I'm not putting that on the plot of this movie, but like imagining how that could work, right? So what would be the scenario where that would be reasonable, where like this person can't speak or these people can't speak, but trying to do that would be really interesting. I have no idea if it would work or not, but
would you have it for every character or just the main characters?
Every character. So everything is communicated with gestures and actions and facial expressions, not with moving mouths. Because there's a lot of that in the original.
I bet it could be done, but
like, think about the scene between him and the woman in the prison. Like, there is no dialogue exchange.
That's true. That's a great scene.
There's basically like a whole, you know, interaction, a lot of sound, conversation. Though. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I want sound, but I don't want speech, nor do I want sort of.
You're right, though. That's speech. A great example of nonverbal communication.
Yep. Yep.
Gastrointestinal communication.
Yeah, that was very surprising to me, as was the cocaine scene. I gotta say, I didn't see cocaine coming in a Charlie Chaplin movie.
Oh man, nose powder.
That really surprised me in the prison.
And the scene after he got out of prison, or no, I'm sorry, when he has his little nervous breakdown in the factory and he's running around looking for things to tighten with his wrench, and the woman comes around the corner with the two buttons on her dress. Like, that was pretty racy for 1936.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
And I love that they kind of did that joke, but then she just runs away from him. And that he does it to Big Bill later on.
Yeah. Yes. Well, is there anything else you guys want to add to this in terms of how you could see a silent movie being in this instance, or a non-silent movie? How do you think it could work as a non-silent movie? Do you think this could be successful as just a run-of-the-mill? Now, this is not directorially, this is not story-wise, but just a sort of standard format film. Do you think Modern Times could be successful that way?
I think that it will be a tall order to make it successful.
Yeah.
But, you would have to have such a killer script. You know, it would need to be as good as it could possibly be in order for it to work.
Yeah.
I agree with Mark. I think that making this a spoken movie would probably make it a very mediocre movie. The story in the original is charming, simple, and the fact that there really isn't much dialogue works in that favor. I think that if you had a lot of dialogue, it may just kind of emphasize the drabness of the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think taking that away kind of tosses out the chaff, and all of a sudden all you have is left is this just really charming, sweet little story.
Yeah.
And to make this a spoken movie, like Mark said, you'd have to have killer writing.
Yep. I just thought of this, and we're going to talk a little bit about sort of silent movies since the time of the silent movie. But an inspiration for me thinking of how this could be done effectively is a movie that is very similar, and especially kind of considering the Tramp character, and that's The Hudsucker Proxy. To me, that is very Chaplin-esque and very Tramp-esque. Now, admittedly, it's very stylized, but I think it's stylized in a way that sort of honors, even thinking of like the cogs and the clock, you know, the gears together.
Totally.
Like, that to me feels very much like this movie. So I could see that being sort of the direction where it could go, to where it's very stylized. You know, the plot of Hudsucker Proxy is not complex. It's a guy that, you know, is sort of put upon to make a company fail, does the total opposite, right? So, I mean, it's not a super complex film, but it's all in how it is delivered and the direction that the Coen brothers do. So, yeah, that suddenly just came to mind as something that could be sort of how that direction could work, sort of stylized-wise.
I would agree. I think if we do this remake with dialogue, it would have to be very, very unique visually. It'd have to have a very strong, just directorial signature on it. And, there would have to be something to replace that charm of all the physicality in the silent film.
Yeah. Well, I think we don't need to make the assumption, though, necessarily, that the physicality would go away. It relied entirely upon it in the original, but I think that could still be there. And I think things could be staged in a way where you could feel that even more. The grandeur could be greater. You know, the scenes of the cogs could be greater. I mean, everything now could be done in a more exaggerated way. Now, that doesn't make it a better way, but it could be a way that is bigger and more exaggerated, more intense. So, you know, I don't think that those are mutually exclusive. I don't think that physicality and speech have to be fully separate. I think you can have both, but both of those have to run on full tilt and be fully effective for it to be successful. I agree.
The option that I don't know if this is where we should go, but
yeah, go for it, Jared. I was just going to say, if you know, you had an idea about kind of an alternative sort of universe for this film.
Well, I think that the idea that I came up with when we first had our production meeting about it was making this almost a movie within a movie, which is a concept that's pretty common. It gets made quite a bit, but almost a movie about somebody either making or remaking Modern Times. And so you have a movie set in whatever time period you have it set in, that's telling the story of a director and actors who are putting together Modern Times, sort of a film within a film. I think that if you did that right and didn't lampoon the silent movie, but made it to show the beauty and the elegance that the silent film era had, that I think in many ways we've lost in current cinema. And I think if it was told in a way that was telling the story of the silent film in an honoring sort of way, while still being its own movie, I think that would be a really unique and really interesting way to show it, that would both give credence to whoever that character playing the tramp would be and relying on them to carry the movie, but also would give us the ability to make a marketable movie that had that wasn't bound by the rules of the silent film.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. I feel like that's too removed, but I think it still could work. I would have to see exactly what it looks like, but there's potential there.
I mean, I think that we've gotten to a point in movie making and effects that it could really be interesting and almost doing like a Pleasantville type idea where the two pieces of it are so drastically different in how they are filmed. And so you literally are filming a silent movie at points during it. And where the camera, even maybe what cameras you use to film it change. And you actually are making a silent movie in the midst of this other movie, but not in a funny way, not in a documentary type way, but legitimately making a silent film.
So like certain scenes between certain characters, maybe always silent. Or nothing else in the movie is, or something like that?
Yeah, always silent, always in black and white, always filmed on maybe a camera that would be more reminiscent of that camera style. It would almost be two different movies sort of intertwined within each other, like a Shakespearean play within a play.
This might be a strange reference, but I would tag Run Lola Run.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are two different cameras used for different relationships in that film. And you know, obviously it's to a different purpose, but in this sort of application, I can really see that working well.
Yeah. Another sort of reference I would put in there is Mulholland Drive, where you don't know what is real. So if maybe you don't know if the silent world is real or whether the, you know, voiced world is real, and like you keep it somewhat ambiguous. Again, maybe this is going too deep down the rabbit hole, but
no,
that could
I love
be
it.
Really interesting too. Nice, man. Fun stuff. This is a great discussion. Love it. So next up is sort of appreciation of the silent film in general, of which we've already admitted we haven't seen a lot of, but we have seen this one and we have a lot of good things to say about it. Andy, do you want to start us off with your sort of appreciation of the film in addition to what we've talked about already?
I do. I mentioned this a lot in the first episode when we actually talked a little bit about it in Jerry, I believe is your pick for a Gaiman, Neil Gaiman.
Probably.
That Charlie Chaplin's physical performance in this movie, from the smallest facial tic to his, you know, largest, most grandiose move, really just defined this movie and was a masterclass in physical comedy that I don't believe we've seen since. I think we've probably seen it in, I think the closest thing I could think of that seeing it was like the Aladdin or the genie in Aladdin, like in animated movies. I feel like that's the only way that we can see this kind of physical performance anymore is in fictional, not even real three-dimensional people characters.
Yeah.
I didn't say that very articulately, but you get what I'm saying.
I hear you.
But you said articulately.
Thank you very much. So that's just, I guess I just want to kind of gush about that a little bit, that he makes every move in this movie is deliberate and purposeful to comedic effect. And even when he's doing things like just sitting down, he does it in a way that you are interested in what he's doing and you pay close attention because you're thinking this is going to be funny. It's like something's going to happen here.
Yeah.
And it probably is going to be funny, but it's probably not from where you're expecting. And he's also a little bit of a, you know, there's a little bit of misdirection, a little sleight of hand that comes in, I think. But a lot of that has to be attributed to the direction of the movie and to the other actors in the ensemble. I talked about some of the choreography that had to have been a part of this movie, thinking like scenes in the factory when he's working on the conveyor belt. And there's like two or three other guys on the conveyor belt as well that are right behind him. And they all have a different menial task to do to this little cog, but they all have to act very, you know, in syncly.
That's not very articulate.
That's not at all. or scenes like, in the cafe, the diner, the dance hall, where there's a scene where the little tramp, the factory worker, is a waiter and he's trying to bring a dinner to a table and he has to get across this incredibly crowded dance floor and everyone's kind of moving together and he's kind of getting caught up in this massive humanity and all this stuff. Like those kinds of scenes in the choreography are just fascinating to me. And I love watching how just these acts of movement, either with many people or just something down to like a wink of his eye, is just brilliantly funny to me.
Yeah, agreed. I'm with you entirely. It was a revelation to see that for me. It was really, really fun.
Yeah, and you and I, Kyle, were both kind of hitting on the same point about this movie was filmed at a certain frame rate and showed at a frame rate that was 1.5 times faster than how it was filmed. And so all of the physical comedy is even more funny because it happens so much more quickly.
Yeah. I think it glosses over a lot of the filmmaking stuff too. Like, I don't think the filmmaking was super tight, but it looked amazing because of that. Like, I think if it were normal speed, you would see a lot of things, but this is sort of the Vaseline on the lens, as it were, of that time.
Yeah, a little bit.
But I'm not saying that critically. It was just how it was, you know? Like, but I don't know if you guys researched it. I meant to, and I did not, so my bad. I apologize. But did they film it? I mean, was this like a crank camera that they just cranked more quickly and then it played back at that rate? Or was this them speeding it up in the projector side of things?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think Lee said something that he knew, right?
Yeah, Lee, what did you find out about that?
Vanity is definitely my favorite sin.
Oh.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. All right. Well, I feel like that wrapped that up pretty nicely.
Yeah. As far as sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
So they didn't just use that technique for comedies. They I saw it in Metropolis, and I'm pretty sure in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari as well. And
it does seem like it was a common theme in many movies of that era.
Yeah, right? And I think like you said, Kyle, it was to sort of make up for the technical deficiencies of the equipment they had at the time.
Well, it just heightened it. And it in the silent movies, they just heightened everything. Like, the reference that I made in one of our earlier movies, Some Like It Hot, like the scene towards the beginning where there's like the shootout with the cars, that's totally sped up. I mean, that's probably about the same. Yeah, so yeah. I think that's, I don't think that was an homage necessarily. I think that was still a practice of when you want to heighten it, the way to do it is not with swooping crane camera things, because they didn't have that. You know, what they had to play with was frame rate. So they were able to do that. Yeah. And it's really effective.
And because I think there's definitely scenes in the movie. Oh, sorry.
I think in the dramas that I mentioned, what it does is it lends an air of, it lends a surreal quality to it, which works really, really well in those kind of art house European films.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Indeed. Yeah. Jared, then you had a note about physical comedy in this movie and sort of how that progressed from the silent film era to today. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I would. Before that, I was just going to tag one last thing onto Andy's point about Charlie Chaplin and his amazingness. I think one of the things, and this is probably why I like Buster Keaton more, going back to our first episode and the question asked there, but Buster Keaton to me, more than Charlie Chaplin, was able to do things with his body and with his emotions and his eyes and his face that I think was at a higher level than Charlie Chaplin. But I think what Charlie Chaplin
was it because
did
of lack of a mustache,
maybe, maybe
that damn mustache.
But what Charlie Chaplin did that was so astoundingly amazing is that his physical comedy was everything around him. He knew how to choreograph a scene with his directing as well as just his ability to act, but he knew how to create a physical comedy gag using the entirety of a set piece. And I mean, you saw that in many different places in the movie. When you first walk into the kitchen, when there's the indoor and the outdoor, and they've got the big trays of food and the inevitable spilling of the food happens. Like, there's just so much going on. He's got extra people everywhere just doing things. And there's just so much movement and so much going on. And he knows how to play into that and write his gag. And then the roller skating shot that we talked about earlier, he knew how to use what he was able to do in such a fantastic way and to write a scene around it and then to choreograph the pieces. It was like a dance, and it was, you just don't have that anymore. Which brings me to my point in researching this movie and in thinking about it, there really has been a progression of physical comedy that has really gone by the wayside. In this era, you had your Charlie Chaplin and your Buster Keaton. And then, after that into the next era of film, you had your Laurel and Hardy and your Three Stooges, and slapstick reigned supreme. And then into people like Jerry Lewis, who just could do things with their body that human beings can't do. And then, and you have your glimmers of physical comedy in sort of modern film, like early Jim Carrey and Chris Farley and people like that. But in thinking about it and in reading some articles and other people's opinions on sort of where comedy is right now, not that this is good or bad, but comedy now, if you look at some of the more popular comedy movies and shows that are coming out, and a great example would be a lot of what is coming out of like the comedy Adult Swim.
Yeah, Adult Swim.
A lot of the Adult Swim programming and like Archer, shows like that. And then even a lot of the comedy sitcoms that are out now, it's shows like Archer, it's all about just rapid fire dialogue. It's all dialogue based.
Yeah, or all the current Chuck Lorre sitcoms like Big Bang Theory and Two Broke Girls. Two and a Half Men.
It's all in the writing. It's all in the dialogue. Creepy. It's all in the writing. Even Comedy Bang Bang. That's just nothing but bizarre dialogue and antics. But it's not anybody doing anything with their physical body or facial expressions or things like that. And if it is, it's part of a larger piece. And so the death of physical comedy is probably a little bit of an overstatement, but when you look at how difficult it is for us to talk about who could portray Charlie Chaplin, it's because there isn't a Charlie Chaplin anymore. That isn't required in movies and film and television entertainment anymore, which is unfortunate. I wish there were people that could do that, but that's not where comedy is anymore, it seems like. And then you have people that try to do it and it just looks oafish and goofy, and it's just it almost becomes a replacement for good writing. Let's just have the character get a football in the groin and that'll be fine. I guess my question is, do you guys think that physical comedy is gone? Is it going? Is it here? Is it just in a different form? Where is physical comedy and do we miss it?
I think it's coming back.
Hmm. Yeah. And I'd agree with that.
And so I think that we've been in this phase of the very heavily dialogue-based comedy for a while now. It's been a good 5 years. And very, very visually stylized comedy, like Comedy Bang Bang, or even Portlandia, is starting to come back. And I think that's going to be the gateway into physical comedy. It might just take the right actor to have that presence that suddenly everybody grabs onto. You know, like, Lord knows Johnny Depp tried.
Yeah,
but I think everybody's off that train now. We just need another person to become the next Charlie Chaplin, and maybe it is Fred Armisen. But I think we'll just have to see. But I do think it's coming back.
Yeah, I would say that physical comedy went from live action things. I kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, from live action things to animated things.
So good point.
And really looking at Roadrunner cartoons, for example. They are nothing but physical comedy. I mean, those are silent films in essence.
Yeah, yeah. Or Tom and Jerry.
Yeah, all those kinds of things that the joke was, Wile E. Coyote gets an anvil falling on his head from a cliff. Or which one was Tom?
Cat.
The cat.
Cat. So Tom gets a frying pan in the face, and suddenly his face is the shape of a frying pan, which is hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
But
true.
Those kinds of things that, you know, animation allows you to do those things that you cannot do in live action. I think it granted a lot more freedom to explore. And I don't know. I don't feel like I've seen, I think Jim Carrey might be a, you know, earlier stuff like The Mask was a lot of physical stuff. I think Robin Williams and some of his younger stuff did a lot of it, but I can't think of any kind of modern performers that are really relying on that as their bread and butter.
Yeah, I think the world around actors became much more active. I think in the earlier times, the actor was the world and everything around him was part of it. You know, I mean, he was really the center of it. Now the world around actors can be much more active, much more dynamic, whether that be in camera or CG. So the actors don't have to do as much to create an impression. In fact, it probably doesn't feel like enough. You know, when you see something like the Avengers, where there's like a giant space worm that's thousands of feet long or whatever flying through the sky, like, how do you compare that to someone that can walk funnily? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, those are two totally different things. And I think they can have their own things.
The Hulk
in their own
kind of funny
space.
Walk.
Oh, totally. Well, and there's a perfect example. The Hulk. Oh my God, the scene with him and Loki. That's like was it Droopy? What's the elevator guy from the cartoons?
Oh yeah,
going up
the dog.
Yeah, Droopy.
It's a Droopy gag where he hits him side to side. That's Droopy. So that was Droopy in an Avengers movie. It totally was. It's a total cartoon homage. But
done entirely in CG.
Exactly. It was a computer. Yep.
So that brings a good point. I think all the live action stuff that we're referencing, that's kind of the modern equivalent, is all almost 100% CG, at least modified.
Yeah. Animated, whether it's a cartoon or otherwise.
Yeah. And so we don't have, I don't think we have a lot of comparisons of live action that was truly as a special effect free as Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin were.
Yep.
So if that's the answer to the question, it's did. It's deed.
Indeed. I mean,
even look at the things that, if you watch The General and other Buster Keaton stuff, and you watch more of Charlie Chaplin, and even to probably a larger degree, the Three Stooges, and what they did to themselves and to each other. Physical comedy, in many ways, is seeing where you can push your limitations as a human being, not in a dangerous way. You're not going to throw yourself off a cliff or drop an anvil on your head. You might drop a fake anvil on your head back in 1936. But I think what Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton did as physical comedians is they wanted to push the envelope to see how far they could do things with their own bodies. And that's what made it so funny, is that they're doing ridiculous things that actors don't need to do anymore, because if it's going to be a physical gag, we'll just CG it later. We'll just have the Hulk throw Loki around like a paper bag, and it'll be funny. And it was funny. Like, that was a great scene in the Avengers, but
yeah,
there was no actor that needed to wonder if he could do that or not.
Yeah. And I love that the line was puny God. You know, like, that's just like the perfect reflection of that. But the only exception that I would say, and this is probably 30 years ago now, but he's a little bit too old to be Charlie Chaplin now, but Bruce Campbell in the Evil Dead movies.
Yeah,
I mean, that's pretty much perfect physical acting to me when he gets inhabited in Evil Dead 2. A little bit less so in Army of Darkness, but man, him in Evil Dead 2 is a perfect example of physical acting done right. Yep. Good discussion. I like that. Good point, Jer. And then let's maybe talk just a little bit about kind of the message of the original. Jer and Andy, you had some thoughts about sort of the political, social side of it. Jer, do you want to start that off?
Well, it's a pretty obvious message, I think, from a political or social standpoint. What, like Andy said before, it's a fairly simple, straightforward plot about industrialization and the ills that may come with that. And how the two main characters are basically destitute at one point. One of them is destitute the entire time, but you had everybody in the factory, then you had the factory shut down, then you had it back to work, and then the strike and everything else. And so there's a pretty strong social message as far as that goes, and in the industrialization of society and how there's positive and negative effects to that, and how everybody sort of lived and died by this factory. The point that I threw out there in our first discussion was that's a wide enough brush to paint with, that's pretty much spot on for a message that would hit home today as well. Maybe it's a different type of machine that's running. It's not a factory that's putting together widgets. It's, you know, maybe it's Silicon Valley or something like that, but I think the general message is one that's probably been played out in movies from the 1930s until today. I think it's probably still a very valid message that would resonate with its audience. Thoughts?
Agreed.
Yeah, agreed.
And I don't know about you guys, but I didn't see any sort of hidden M. Night Shyamalan message or twist or anything. It was pretty much straightforward. on the sleeves of what they were trying to point out.
Yeah, agreed.
Until that one scene when it turned out that he was dead the whole time.
<It's true. laughs> and a communist.
And a superhero. Don't forget that.
A superhero, yeah.
I did like the little side plot where he actually wanted to stay in prison because his life was so much better.
That's
an interesting little message on society and how we treat the lower class versus how we treat prisoners, I suppose.
Yeah,
and there's Orange is the New Black. There's a character that gets out of the jail and then comes back. Because she didn't know how to live outside of prison.
Yep, that's a great reference. Absolutely.
There's the only other thing that I thought needed some interpretation about this film was the curious names of the characters. It's obvious that that Chaplin didn't want to name his character, just because it could be anybody. The thing that struck me about the factory worker and the gamin were that they're not the factory worker and the gamin; they're a factory worker and a gamin. And I think that lends even more of an everyman quality to both of them. Yeah, it could be any of us. And I think that was really his big point about the film, is that anybody could be in the same dire straits that they were.
Yep, agreed.
It would be far less hilarious, though.
It's true. All right, so the last thing that we're going to discuss here is just some post-modern time silent film examples. And if you have seen these and would like to chime in, please feel free to do so. The Artist is probably the most current one, which had some Oscar attention. Andy, I believe you saw that and weren't a huge fan, right?
I did see it and I did not like it. I felt like it was a silent movie ripoff of Singing in the Rain to a large degree. I thought the plots were very similar, and this movie was just very self-congratulatory, and the Oscars that year were very self-congratulatory, and this was just kind of their crown jewel of self-congratulation. I don't know. I mean, it's maybe I needed to see it again to see if it held up differently, but I didn't feel like it was this profound cinematic experience. I felt like they were, let's make a silent movie in the spirit of the old silent movies and relive vintage Hollywood.
Got it. So it was done just so they could say that they did a silent movie, not because it had a purpose to it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
I'm just bitter.
That's all right. The next one is Silent Movie, which is a Mel Brooks movie, which could not be more different from The Artist in every way, in all the glorious ways. Any one commentary on that?
I've seen it. I haven't seen it recently, so I couldn't really tell you much about it, except that I know that there's only one spoken word in it, and it's spoken by a mime, which I think is brilliant.
That's awesome.
Yep, agreed. The next one is WALL-E, which I threw on there, which is about the first third half of the movie is it's not officially silent. It is essentially a silent movie where WALL-E is just sort of discovering the world around him, and it is absolutely masterful filmmaking. I mean, I think it's...
Totally.
It's hard to go against the montage scene in Up in terms of greatest Pixar scenes, but that first half of WALL-E is probably the best filmmaking that they've ever done. And the computer work is glorious. It's filmed impeccably. And I say filmed because the work that they did in terms of emulating cameras, I saw a video out of that. I'll see if I can find it. It was really interesting talking about like how they tried to emulate the different camera views in WALL-E. They had... who's the Coen brothers DP? Lubieski, maybe? No. Anyways, the director of photography for all of the Coen brothers movies worked on WALL-E, and it shows. Like, it's just extraordinary filmmaking. So, yeah, I love that movie so hard.
I remember when that came out, I think you saw it before I did, Kyle, and you kind of, I think you gave me a little, I don't know, warning's not the right word, but like you kind of gave me a heads up that the first part of this movie was essentially without dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I remember finding some stuff online about people were getting really upset about that.
Yeah.
And I remember, and then I saw the movie and I had the same reaction that you did, Kyle. I thought it was an absolutely beautiful film. And I remember thinking like, I felt sad that people thought that section of the movie detracted from the movie because there wasn't talking.
Yeah. I think it's one of those situations where attention was drawn to it for all the right reasons that ended up in all the wrong results. So people came into it thinking, okay, this is going to be you know, 50 minutes of silence, essentially. You know, it's like when people talk about, you know, I knew the first 17 minutes of Gravity was going to be one take, you know, in this case, it's sort of CG assisted, but like I knew that was going to be there. But then when I was in it, about a minute four, I stopped paying attention to that and was just like, holy crap, what is going on? This is insane. You know what I mean? So like when art does what it should do, your attention is drawn to it. And then if done really well, or if you can just be absorbed in it, then it goes away, right? That attention goes away and you're just in the moment. Not everybody can do that. And I'm not saying I'm holier than thou or better than anybody else in any way, shape, or form. But I think some people can't get past that attention. And I'm guilty of it too. Like if I hear critics, that will sometimes color things in a way that I can't overcome. And that's something I would like to work on as a film goer. So I tend not to read a lot about movies before I go and see them for that very reason. And then the next one here is All Is Lost, which I think is the Robert Redford one, right? Who added that to that?
Yeah, I added that. I haven't actually seen it, but that's the recent Robert Redford film where he's out at sea on a boat that breaks down. And apparently there's almost no dialogue in it.
Yeah, there's very, very little.
And there's only one character in it.
Yep. Yeah, I think Castaway sort of teased that a little bit. But I thought it was like the character relationship between him and Wilson, you know, the volleyball, was really interesting. I thought that was very well played. So I think that was maybe the training wheels for that type of movie, like potentially getting out there like that. So interesting. I would like to see that. I will definitely check that out. I think it's on Netflix streaming now, maybe. I don't know. I can't remember.
It's on one of the two free services I know, or one of Amazon Prime or Netflix. I know it's on one of them.
Yep. Yep. Yes, indeed. Any other examples before we close up shop, gents?
Mm-mm.
All right. Well, that does it here for the second part of our discussion of Modern Times. And I want to say that was awesome. That was really fun. I think we discussed a lot of really good stuff here, and it was just everything I like about talking with you guys. So thank you for that.
Good job, us.
If you want to find out, good job, us. Yeah.
Yay.
Yay.
Good job, Lee.
Yay. If you want to find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast or blog on the Math is Hard Network, check us out at mathishard.net. You can find show notes there and incorporated in the podcast episode on your podcast client of choice. There you can find links to actors, actresses, and movies, or just links in general discussed in this episode. You can find us on both Twitter and Facebook at username mathishardnet. Our next episode will be released on November 17th, where we will be discussing Good Morning Vietnam. So, gents, again, like I said, thanks so much for hanging out and talking with me. It's wonderful, as always. Until the next time, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.